Fred Collins, reel two.
On old beds, we had a framework to put on your mosquito nets, etc. And when you went to bed at night time, you got into bed and you took your mosquito net in all round you, prevent being bitten mosquitoes, etc. And I also remember the first night I slept there, we'd been told all sorts of tales about various people and Indians coming in the ticks they got up to. And I woke up just afore the valley. I didn't hear in the valley. I wondered what it was, and somebody touching me. And a big fella, big fierce-looking Indian with a beard around him, a red kimono type of thing, and an open razor at me. So, and I was speechless. I just looked at him, and eventually he said, "Shave, Sam." I said, "No, I'll shave myself." I was glad to get rid of him. And I only shaved myself from there onwards. But they used to come round first thing in the morning, before the valley, and they shave a man while he's asleep, as long as they had the authority to shave him. But being your recruit, they had to find out, first of all, from me whether I wanted to be shaved regularly. Most of the lads did get shaved regularly by them, but I was shaved something out by them when I felt like it. And, but the first time was quite a shock to see this fellow wake up. And all that got round the place without anybody hearing them, you know, that was a shock to us as well. There was, an orderly on duty all the time in the place. And in the middle of the barrack room, there was what they call a rifle rack, where everybody put the rifles in, and then they were locked into that place, and there had to be a man on duty, what they call a room orderly all the time, in that place. And of course, he would see the Indians come in on the morning, let them go to work as usual, you see, because it's a regular thing in the place.
Did you have any servants?
Eventually, there was servants there, but really, you were entitled to get you're only entitled to a servant as a sergeant once you got to be a sergeant. So what happened, your sergeant was entitled to a waiter or a fella to look after him. A boy, as we always called him. He might be older than me, and I am now, but he used to call him boy. And he was paid so much by the sergeants, and he also had a pass saying that he was the boy to the particular sergeant getting out of the barracks later. So that was his ticket to a good living, because the rest of the platoon used to get most of the gear done by this boy. He'd employ other boys and all of that job. And they'd do all your equipment and things like that, do anything you want for you. As a sergeant, I was a sergeant in Amritsar. When I come back off the plane, you don't have a sergeant, you don't have a waiter or a boy when you're out on the frontier, of course, on the manoeuvre. But these boys could go, the waiters, and they'd get you anything. You used to say you wanted a new shirt or something like that, and of course you'd get your shirts made to measure then. They'd go and get the jersey, bring the jersey, or that's the tailor, and they'd bring them to your room at night time, and they'd measure you for a shirt or a suit, whatever you wanted. And, they used to make some damn good jobs of all your gear was fitted to you, even getting measured for a pair of shoes. You want a pair of civvy shoes, you went down to the mooch, I call him like that, the fellow did the shoemaking, and you sort of put your foot on the board, he drew round it and then measured over the top of it and round your ankle, and within no time he produced you a good pair of shoes, really good pair of shoes. I know just before I came home in 1938-39, I could get three pair of shoes made to measure, and one of them for ladies, probably in proper snakeskin, not just imitation stuff, and that would cost me about 50 rupees, which is just over, 50 shilling, 54 pence, and get them transported to England for that, three pair of shoes. There was, they had some advantages, of course, in being abroad in India like that.
How did you choose your servants?
Well, eventually, once you become a sergeant, there were so many available, and the contractor to the barracks used to do all this business. He'd have the canteen, and all the boys that used to come round selling their tea, what they call their chowwallers, they'd sell tea, and they'd have a big tea in that carried around, big brass, a copper tea in. And his friend would be with him with a big box, and in there he'd have cakes, chars and wads, as we used to call them. And sandwiches, he used to have all sorts. He used to bring it out at night time, chicken sandwiches, fish banjos, as you call them, and steak banjos. You get all sorts from them lads at night time. And of course, the contractor produced so many men for you and would recommend so many men to the place, you see. And, all the time I was a sergeant, I had one with us after I came back off the frontier. And no, quite good lads do anything for you, really. And you would, as a sergeant, if you wanted to, I was too energetic, but you could wake up and all, they'd come and wake you with a cup of tea to start off with, like, the boy. And he'd have all your gear laid out, your socks rolled down smartly, so you just slipped your foot in the bottom, and they'd even roll them up where you wanted to. I used to do all my own with regards to dressing and things. But the others, a lot of people, you said, and as you put your socks on, then he'd have your pair of short pants or whatever you had to go and play with that immediately. So you just step into them. all your shoes are absolutely polished, your gear was laid on. And it was more or less put onto you, and off you went on parade. And he was there to take it off you when he came back. So there was, as I say, and the little message whenever you wanted to. And as I said, I think we used to, I used to pay them, I think it was 1.5 rupees, which would be 1 and 6 and 9, was like 2 and 7s. And that was what, that was officially what we had to pay them, like. And of course, as I said, they made more money, but they made a bigger lot of money by cleaning up for the lads around the party. You see, you'd only clean my there all day, you clean my kit, then go and clean most of the lads on the platoon and things like that. You get, makes quite good money on it.
How was it best to treat them, the servants?
Oh, I always treated them like a human being. I believe that's the best, no matter where you are, to treat everybody fair and square. I used to talk to them like talking to a normal friend when you came in to see us, you know. And he used to tell us his family troubles. He had, you know, his wife and kiddies and things like that. Sometimes that was hard for him to get moving with them. He used to get a horse. I think he was quite friendly with the people eventually. You weren't supposed to, you had to keep him in the place, but I think they knew the place, and they knew they were getting a good living, provided they didn't... you got to one or two bands on about the place, but the majority of them were quite good lads. I found them all right, anyway.
Did anybody have any trouble with them?
I can't remember any troubles. I mean, they all said there was what they call loose wallows around the place, pinching things like that, but you could never, with the barracks being wide open, even your barrack rooms are wide open, the big archways, I mean, they get the cools off with verandas on, they get the cools after nail to cool the place down at night time. So they were pretty wide open, but you had to keep everything locked up so they didn't lose stuff. And I think on the whole they were pretty... the men that worked on the barracks, because you didn't see much of the other lot. You got into the towns, the near, near enough. We were at Merritt, and you got near the towns there. You could go to the town at night time, but there's mostly you only went to the pitches and you came back again. And that was it, because there was no sort of big dancing places for you to go to. Out like that. Bingo wasn't organised, it wasn't a fad like it is here. But you could go to places like Sandy's Homes, they used to be run by volunteers from England or some other country, and you could go in there, more or less like a canteen, reading rooms and things like that, and games rooms. That was where you passed your time away. Unless you were doing sort of athletics work, which you normally daily part of the evening, you filled in your evening then. And of course, you had your canteens and your calls and sergeant's messes and officers' messes to fill your time in with. And that was more on the plains, had you? Merritt, that was the sort of plains. You trained now and again. You went shooting on the ranges. At Merritt, there's a big rifle range. There was competitions throughout the area and all that shooting. And we did a certain amount. We were told we were going on the frontier then in 1937. We started doing training and lectures from the place, and the officers were taking us on what they call chutes, tactical exercise without troops. And that sort of landscapes of the frontier. And they used to tell us how you move forward on the frontier, doing picketing, as they call it, opening the roads and things like that. And then we even had to imagine that there was hills on the plains outside the place and go and do actual marching round and doing this picketing. I know you're probably on top of one of the rifle butts or something, calling it a mountain or something. And eventually we went off to the frontier from Merritt, and we left a lot of lads behind that were due to finish more or less in the next 3 or 4 months and go to England, you see. And they say that the soldier's a rough lad, no thought for anybody else, but it's surprising. There was a lot of tears in the eyes of people, you know, the men staying behind, and the lads marching out when they're leaving pals behind. You get to know people. See, now, having been in the army 13 years, I knew eventually those lads I was soldiering with better than I knew my brothers, because he hadn't seen my brothers for years. And that's where you get a really brotherly comradeship among yourselves. Anyway, we went on the frontier from Merritt, and
did you feel when you were told you were going to the frontier?
Well, again, as I say, once you're out there, it's another experience. You're wondering what there's people do shooting and God knows what when you get there. Well, you've been saying to shoot, so and the biggest part of the barrack room, or should I say the barrack square shouting, is to discipline people so that they move quickly when they do a job, and so they're aware of command, the man's doing something. And you're going abroad there, so you went abroad. You went up to the frontier, and that was quite a journey on the train, a rough riding again. And we got to Mariindus, where they changed the gauge of the train, and they changed to a normal train service to what they call a narrow gauge. It was only about 3 foot wide at the most, and your carriage just seemed to be overbalancing. And that took you across the desert. There was a desert there from Mariindus up to Banhill, with only one rest halfway across it, where you got out for a meal. There was 8 hours in that train across the desert. So you wanted your water and your ice before you moved off to keep it. And we stopped at one particular spot. It's only a very small place. You couldn't call it a village, more or less like a big hall and a cooking depot. And the fella ran it very well, and we had a meal laid on there after the halfway mark, and then on to Banhill. The same when we were coming back, we saw somebody, when he saw this petty going up the frontier and coming down the frontier after about 18 months. After. And we got to Banhill. We landed in Banhill, which is sort of stepping off place for the North West Frontier to go on to Waziristan there. And there, just before we moved up on the line, most of the lads decided to go and get the haircuts, and they got the haircuts same as the gear, because there's very little, just a wee bit left on the back. Didn't know what they call pull them into heaven to us. And when the officers saw it, eventually they say, oh, there were so many, they got done, he sent across and played war and stopped the nappy from, that's the, what they call a nappy, is the barber, stopped him from cutting them so short, like, because he said, I go up there like that, I think I'm coming on there with a gang of convicts. We eventually then embarked from Banhill into a fleet of old Albion buses, and went up into a place called Garryholm. It's about 75 miles inside Waziristan. It's where our first place in the frontier. And these old Albion trucks, a real old steam makers to look at, but they said they did a job of work up and down them mountains, and the drivers make your eyes pop out. Some of the mountains are going around them. You think you're going to go straight over the edge, and the speed they did, it was nobody's business. And of course, there was our initiation to it. It was going along the road, a few shots hitting even the vehicles as they're driving. Good God, I wouldn't miss the driver. We stayed over the lot of it. But we were fortunate. We had nobody yet going on the job. But you could see that these things were fired at regularly, because there was bullet holes in them all. When you looked at some of the old vehicles they had there, you marvelled really when you saw them. And the journey to begin was 75 miles up mountains and all sorts of twists and turns in them.
Did you camp overnight?
We did the 70-mile straight up, 75-mile straight up, and into the camp at Yon End. The camp had been made, actually, Gary Hump camp had been made, the sort of dugouts, and outlined round the dugouts with the stones, bricks, etc., and then mutty over the top, and the smoke, that's mud and straw, dried over top of them, and a smooth bottom inside them, so you lay down. But unfortunately, they'd been made by the Gurkhas, for the Gurkhas only about 5'2". Well, I'm not tall as 5'6" or 5'7", and that was too small for me, dude. And we all had to sleep in those tents, you know, there was just room to move up and down, with the other 160-pound tent set over top of that place and rigged up. And that's what you slept in all the time, you're on the front there, those things, while in that particular area. And you had your, when you went to bed, you had your rifle chained to your wrist, well, like a dog lead, like a chain dog lead, and that was chained there. And you laid side by side with you, and you must have to turn over by number, so if somebody went on end on a turn, we all turned over together, and they rattled the chain. And Gary Hump was a big camp, you know, a big open camp. There was a loose brick wall built right round the outside of it, and protruding from each of these brick walls was a sort of... what do we call it? A small sangar, a place to house a section or a platoon in various places right round for the, what the mounted guards do on the day and night round these places, you see. And everybody, excuse me, stood two at night time through the run the wall watching the guards that were on there and then the people inside. Everybody was on parade at dawn, just before dawn rather, and again just at dusk. And there'd probably be an hour, half an hour, you know, while things setting, the sun was either setting or rise, whatever it did. And during that time, then the company commander would probably have a talk to you, platoon commander would have a talk to you what's happening, what's been happening, and as you went along the places, so he'd keep interested. Or he'd start asking you if you had any questions, any troubles, things like that. It was a sort of get-together, that particular, that hour, instead of being stood to and boring, was made use of. And they rigged up inside this perimeter camp, place for the canteen, officers' mess and sergeants' mess, place like that. A very big chamois, as they call them. That's a very big marquee type of thing. And they had sort of acetylene lamp things to give the light in the place, like inside the tent. But they always used to also give a certain light so the snipers could have a go at them. There was one particular night, in one particular night, I was saying that this big chamois, the lights are on, and the snipers eventually decided to have a go at it and put a number of bullets inside the officer's mess. And the one of the officers, I remember him saying, I never saw anybody scatter so quickly inside the place. He said, but the CO was still sat there when we all went back in shamefacedly, like the CO was still sat there on his stick at the place. And you often got things like that where there's, you know, be everything quiet. You never got any sort of warning when it was going on. It just, everybody was quiet, expect, you know, or taking normal part in whatever life it is around the camp. And suddenly a burst of shots, and that was it, and away out the road. And we had one particular spot on there, outside the camp. There used to be so many places outside the camp. There's a place that, outside, one of the big sangars, as they called it, was what we called, we christened, we'd taken over off the South Wales borders, and we christened it the... Richmond Castle, after our depot at Richmond. There's a photograph of the place there. You can take them with it afterwards, anyway. And we used to do a week up there at the time, do a week on that particular job, then go back into the camp itself. But on, you had a platoon up there. We were machine gun platoon in that particular spot. And inside your platoon, you did so many hours on and so many hours off during the full week while you're on the station in that place. And you also did, when they were going to open the road to various places, all the other companies were detailed in the various pickets that went out together. And, of course, you with your machine guns from that particular spot could cover them going out of barracks to the various nearby pickets. And you could also cover them on the return journey when they came back as part of the defence system for the place.
How far away from the camp was it?
That's on side there. It'd only be a matter of 200 or 300 yards away from the place. And, of course, it's much higher. That was on the hill, on one of the mountains again, the side, you know. You could see each other from the place, like in daylight, and you could signal all over the place with the heliograph, particularly, and it'd carry for miles. And you used to keep in touch with the heliograph or flag and things like that. You didn't have any present day wireless systems or telephone wires laid on. We had our first cattle. We used to go opening the roads. What I mean by opening the roads, if we had to get fuel through from Banu, which is the supply depot place, all the troops between Banu and Razmak had to open out the roads. So pickets each side of the road for the whole 75 miles. And you covered your area with pickets. You know what I'm saying? And you went out from your company, and the first two pickets went on either side of the road, on the hills either side. Then the battalion moved forward through, and then the next two pickets would go further up until you're all deployed. And you're pulling in your first two pickets that went out and pull in, and maybe you have to go on the pickets further on, depending on what distance you were covering. And then the same sort of leapfrogging inside the pickets all the time until you went out and come back. And they used to sort of open the road. And the people used to come from Banu with the goods, whatever we were going to get, ammunition, groceries, everything. I come to Razmak and then back again, all within the 24, the day we had it open, late and back. So they had to be moving some. And invariably there was a few shots fired, you know, practically every time. Very few casualties and that type of thing. But we had our first casualty at Garryholm. excuse me. We had one fella shot through with a dum-dum bullet through the hip, one of our sides, through the femur, and that bone was really shattered, and he was in trouble for quite a long time. He was taken off the frontier and up to Razmak on the frontier, which was a frontier station with a hospital built inside it. Like. And he was in there about 6 or 7 months after when we rejoined him, when we went to take over in Razmak.
What was the medical treatment like where you were?
Well, most of the stuff was, where to begin with, was first aid stuff on the field, like, and just had your field ambulances with you. And, of course, when there was, in a case like that, where you're really badly wounded, they'd get them, you'd open the roads again, you had to have the roads safely to get them to Razmak. And there's hospital beds there. It was quite a decent hospital, like, with what material they had those days. And used to do fairly well. You get kicked playing football or scratching. The countryside was really filthy, and it was rough, open countryside. Very little foliage at all on the place in Razmak and that area. And just open, rough mountains. If you fell down, you scraped yourself, you invariably had to go and get an anti-tetanus inoculation and things like that. Even playing football, you could go and get a knock. And that was the type of country, was it? You had to be very careful, even when you were very fit. Surprised now you got a cut and it would fester for ages unless it was really looked after, you know. Very careful. And we spent the first 3 months up on the front in the Garryholm district, sort of fanning out from there, showing the flag from there and place. And then until Christmas 19, the 15th of December actually, 1937. And we went back then to a place called Morali for the Christmas time. And that was supposed to be the end of that particular operation. Operation was declared finished, like, so that means we'd been serving in an active service. We weren't an active service, although we were still inside the frontier. And we spent our Christmas in this particular place, and they had a real rough do after we enjoyed the celebration of Christmas night, and next morning everybody was up all the rest of the night, you know, everybody. The toilets was full. All the battalion was down with it. some sort of dysentery or something that particular day. I never saw it like in your life. And you couldn't be particular. You just had to do it where you were outside. As long as you got outside, that was it. That ought to be cleaned up afterwards, of course. And after we'd been there a while, football matches and cricket matches and things like that with the various other people, the Gurkhas and Sikhs, things like that. Eventually, we had to go back onto the frontier proper to do our turn of duty at Razbak. That was for the 12-month there in Razbak itself. And that's where they've got barrack rooms built in Razmak. And again, outposts on the outside, one particular one being the Rifleman's Tower, as they called it. That was a sort of three-storey building with the steel doors, barbed wire around it, of course, all around the place. And again, you went out as a platoon. And you were on there for a week again. But you used to have to take the battalion at the open, although you could see it only a football field or something like that between you. A couple of companies had to be deployed outside while you went across that particular no man's land and settled into it. And then they were withdrawn and you were left there for the 7 days. And you got into the place by a ladder and you pulled the ladder up and locked the iron doors inside and you watched out from holes in the walls, for firing position, the sort of castellated area on the top where you could walk around and do the sentry business on top and get a good view all around the place, like, from that one.
Which did people prefer? Did they look forward to these 7 day stints?
Eventually, yes, I think they did, because you were away from the battalion, you weren't mounting guards every day, you were under your platoon corporal, platoon sergeant, I was a platoon corporal and in charge of it. So that you ran the place to suit yourself and to suit the men, as long as you kept it clear. Because, you never know when the company would decide, like, we'll open the road up and go and see what they're doing and clear the place. I see. So you did really keep the place tidy, but you were relaxed.